Your next speaker is Lyndall R. Doty.
Mark chapter 12, verse 29 through 34, where Jesus said, "The greatest commandment is to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind, and love thy neighbor as thyself." And in order that we might meet our obligations to love God and to love our neighbor, we must, in order to love our neighbor as ourselves, in fact, love ourselves, to some extent at least. Not selfishly or indulgently, but rather with a correct Christian viewpoint, we must show concern for ourselves. And I talked with you last week about a few things that we owe ourselves then. Since we have reason to love ourselves, God created us in His image and we are His children, and He thought we were valuable enough to die for us, to send His Son to die for us. And He did that and was willing to do so, then we ought to consider ourselves of some importance at least, not to discredit ourselves at all times and not to have a pessimistic outlook on life and in our own abilities, but rather to use those things which God has given us to the fullest of our extent, our fullest extent possible. We need to seek the highest possible attainment with our life. You owe it to yourself to do the best you can with what God has given you. You owe it to yourself for your own happiness and contentment and joy and peace of mind, to do the best you can with what you have. And then secondly, we owe it to ourselves to know God, to really know God, to know His will, to know about Him, to know our relationship with Him, to keep His instructions and to keep His commandments, which prove that we know God, according to 1 John chapter 2, verse 3 to 6. And then also, we need to know ourselves. We owe it to ourselves to know ourselves, to really look within ourselves and give ourselves a self-examination, to evaluate ourselves, recognize our shortcomings, recognize our strengths, and then be willing to live with what we are. I've told the ladies on Tuesday morning, or Tuesday afternoon, I spoke to them, and I told them, one lady said on one occasion that the happiest day of her life was when she finally accepted the fact that she would never win a beauty contest. Well, we need to learn, you see, not to expect more than perhaps we have the right to expect because of our limitations, because of our ability. All of us are not handsome and beautiful, and all of us are not 6 foot. I always wanted to be 6 foot, but I've given up. I don't think I'm going to make it. In fact, I think I'm getting shorter instead of taller. But you know, Jesus said, "Do not be anxious," didn't He, "about your stature? Can you add 1 inch to it? Can you add 1 inch to the measure of your life or to the measure of your body? No, you can't." And so we have to accept ourselves as we are, to some extent at least. To know ourselves, then, is we owe it to ourselves to know ourselves and to come to grips with ourselves and accept ourselves. Now, fourthly, I talked about the fact that we owe it to ourselves to be true to ourselves, to be willing to follow the instructions of our own oughtness, that sense which God has given us to know that we ought to do right and we ought not to do wrong and so forth, and then to have that conscience taught according to the will of God and be willing to do or act in accordance with what one knows he ought to do and ought not to do. We owe it to ourselves not to have a guilty conscience. There's no reason for it. Now tonight, I want to mention a point or two that I think will be helpful as we continue this theme or this idea. What do we owe ourselves? Tonight, first of all, we owe ourselves to think what we ought to think. I heard one of the speakers on the Fried Hartman lectures say that the only problem that atheists have is what they believe. The only problem with people who rob and steal and so forth is what they believe. The only problem that people have in reality who go out and commit adultery and fornication and involved in all kinds of illicit activities are what they believe. It's what they're thinking about. It's what they think about that causes them to go in that direction. And so as you've heard me say before, I want to say again that Jesus did say that out of the heart come the issues of life. And as the proverb writer would say in Proverbs 23, verse 7, "As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he." It is the case that we may not be what we think we are, but we are what we think. So how important is it that we recognize the responsibility to ourselves to think right things, to inculcate within our hearts and minds and knowledge things that we ought to be thinking about? And this is what Paul, of course, says in Philippians chapter 4, verse 8, to think on those things which are good and right and honorable. And he gives a list of things that we ought to be thinking about. And not to think about those things which are darkness and which are not conducive to good, positive Christian attitudes. And I don't think we can stress that too much. We can't stress it to our young people enough. Listen, if you were to poll, young people, if you were to poll those of us who are 35 and older, and were to ask them on a very personal basis, on a one-to-one relationship, if you had it to do over again, Brother Doty, would you not read some things and not see some things and not experience some things? You know what I'd tell them? Oh, if I had it to do over again, I'd never expose myself to some of those things. And some of you would say the same thing. Some things that I could have kept from scarring my conscience and my soul. Some of you know what I'm talking about. And young people, I want to encourage you that you do not fill your hearts and minds up with the things that are in this world and the filth that is so relevant and are prevalent, rather, in our society and in our world, and then expect to be able to do what God would have you to do as a Christian. You can't. You cannot be what you ought to be unless you think what you ought to think. You owe it to yourself. Even though those thoughts may flash in your mind, those thoughts that we ought not to entertain are there. We must not entertain them. We must not keep them in our hearts and minds. We must remove them if at all cost and think on good things. Now, we owe it to ourselves in a second way tonight to use our life for others. Now, I'm not talking about the good that we can do for others. I'm talking about what we owe to ourselves and the good that it can do for us. I'm talking about, if you want to, just think of it in a selfish way. How could I benefit from the things I'm talking about? How do I benefit? These are things that I owe myself. Are they really things that I owe myself? Why do I owe them to? Because you're going to benefit from them. It has always been the case that that Jesus expects of us to use our life for others. In fact, he goes so far to say that he that would lose his life shall gain it. And he's not talking about he would take his life in suicide or he that would die in some other way, but he's talking about he who would die to the world and be willing to give of himself in service. That's the kind of thing he's talking about. Would have life, not the kind of life that is physical in its nature, but the kind of life that is spiritual and joy and peace and all that God promises us. One must be willing to deny himself. He must reject himself and truly regard Christ as the master of his life. In Matthew 16, 21 to 34, or 21 to 24, Jesus is talking about and has been teaching his disciples that he's going to have to go into Jerusalem and suffer. He says, from this time began Jesus to show unto his disciples that he must go into Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed the third day and be raised up. And Peter took him and began to rebuke him, saying, be it far from thee, Lord, this shall never be unto thee. But he turned and said unto Peter, get thee behind me, Satan. Thou art a stumbling block unto me, for thou mindest not the things of God, but the things of men. Then said Jesus unto his disciples, if any man would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it, and whosoever shall lose his life for my sake shall find it. This passage of Scripture gives some comparisons between the man who follows Satan and the man who follows Christ, the man who follows God and follows God's will and has God's interest at heart. Now notice the comparison. Satan says, spare yourself. And that's the reason, you see, Peter says, no, Lord, don't talk that way. It's not going to happen. Why, you're not going to have to go down to Jerusalem and die there. Well, we're not going to let that happen to you. It's just not going to happen that way. Satan says, spare yourself. Satan says, why should you deny yourself for others? But you see, Christ says the way to live is to die to self. In other words, to be separated from the selfishness and the worldliness which can so entrap us and enslave us in this world. That we become so selfish that we have no interest in others, that we are self-centered, that we are primarily interested in number one instead of others. The way to have your life is to lose it, that is, in service to others and therefore to God and to Christ. According to Matthew 25, verse 31, Jesus says, when you do these things to the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me. What are some ways that we lose ourselves in service? What are some things that we can do in order to really be involved in service that would be the kind of demand that Jesus makes of us? To deny our own selfish interests, to deny our own personal inclinations, and rather to take up the cross of servitude and follow Him. What are some things that we can do? Well, first of all, it seems to me that we can be involved in benevolent activities. We can help other people. In the class this morning, we talked about a negative aspect, more or less, of helping others and how sometimes it doesn't you don't always receive the benefits that you think you'd like to receive. But those kinds of benefits and blessings are not measured just by the results that we'd like to get. Really, we're talking about not the benefit that we can do others. We're not talking about the benefit that the church might profit from it, but really we're talking about, and I'm talking about right now, that I owe it to myself to give of myself to others. To try to help other people. Help those who are in need, whatever the need might be, as is pictured in Matthew 25. Or like the Good Samaritan, and I spoke on the radio this week, who was, I think, is so characteristic of the problems that we have today. All of us are so busy, you know, we're so busy being religious in some cases, and we don't have time for people. Preachers can get in that rut. You know, we get so busy doing church work, you know, preparing sermons and teaching classes and that kind of thing, that we forget about people. And after all, that's what it's all about, isn't it? And it's such a challenging, a responsibility to remember that, like the Good Samaritan was, we must take the time, whatever time it takes, to help those who have a need. The priest went on his way, and I can just imagine what he must have been saying. I don't have time for this. Well, here's an old man over here. He might be pretending. It's going to cost me money. I don't have time to mess with him. I don't have any obligation to him. Somebody else will take care of him. But he did not meet his responsibility. And the Levite came along, you see, and passed by on the other side. Here's the second number one, or second to number one, as far as God's responsibility, or God's authority, God's means through which mediatorship in the Old Testament. But the Levite didn't have time for the man. Oh, he was a brother. A fellow Jew. But the priest didn't have time, and the Levite didn't have time. And here comes the Samaritan along. A man who is hated by the Jews and who normally hates Jews. But the Good Samaritan can see the man laying in the ditch and could see himself in that situation. And ask himself the question, what should I do? If I were in that situation, what would I want someone to do for me? And so here's an example of this kind of activity, of being willing to give of ourselves. That is illustrated by the Lord. The Lord promises us that if we will have that attitude and have that kind of action, that He'll bless us with really what we want. But I'm afraid sometimes that we do not believe really that the Lord is going to bless us with what we really want. Satisfaction, joy, peace, and all those things, happiness. He promises us to us if we'll be willing to help others. In Galatians 6, verse 1, if any brother stumble, if he becomes unfaithful, if he sins, ye who are spiritual, restore such one in the spirit of gentleness, lest thou also be tempted. And James 5, verse 19 and 20. If any among you err from the truth, my beloved brethren, if any among you err from the truth, and one convert him from the error of his way, let him know that he that converteth a sinner from the error of his way shall save a soul from death and shall cover a multitude of sin. We can help brethren. In fact, in verse 10 of Galatians chapter 6 says, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all men, especially those of the household of faith. There is a blessing found because we're giving of ourselves. And Jesus did say in Acts 20, verse 35, it is more blessed to give than receive. It is more joyful. It is more rewarding to give than receive. He would say in Luke's account of the Sermon on the Mount, in Luke 6 and verse 38, give and it shall be given unto you. Pressed down, running over, shall it be given into your bosom. If you read the context, he's talking about our treatment of other people. How do we act toward other people? How do we treat other people? What kind of service do we give to other people? What kind of help do we give to other people? What kind of needs are met by us? We give of ourselves, and the blessings will come. In 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 9, for you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though He was rich, yet for your sakes He became poor, that ye through His poverty might become rich. We must exemplify Christ in our service. And also, of course, not only in performing activities of meeting the needs and giving of ourselves and giving of our money, as the case may be, but also of giving of our time in teaching other people the gospel of Jesus Christ. The most important service that we can do. It may be all right to help a person with a meal. It may be all right to help a person with a coat. It may be all right to help a person with a bed and a roof over their head. But we must primarily, most importantly of all, be concerned about whether they know the truth or not, and whether they are saved or not, and whether they have Jesus Christ as Lord or not. And so then, we owe it to ourselves to use our life for others. And then thirdly tonight, we owe it to ourselves to follow ourselves what we teach others. We really owe it to ourselves. For our own good, for our own benefit, for our own relationship to God, for our own happiness, for our own peace of mind. We owe it to ourselves to do what we ask others to do. To do what we as Christians say that other people ought to be involved in. In Romans chapter 2, Paul is comparing the Jew and the Gentile. In this particular section, in beginning with verse 17, he's talking about the Jew. Notice the comparison, or what could be done or could be said about Christianity as well. But if thou bearest the name of Jew, and restest upon the law, and gloriest in God, and knowest His will, and approvest the things that are excellent, being instructed out of the law, and are confident that thou thyself art a guide of the blind, a light of them that are in darkness, a corrector of the foolish, a teacher of babes, having in the law the form of knowledge and of the truth, and thou therefore that teachest another, teachest thou not thyself? Thou that preachest a man should not steal, dost thou steal? Thou that sayest a man should not commit adultery, dost thou commit adultery? Thou that abhorrest idols, dost thou rob temples? Thou who gloriest in the law, through thy transgression of the law, dishonorest thou God? For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. Can you see the application? Not only, you see, is it valuable to the Lord, not only is it valuable to the church that we live in keeping with our instructions and what we teach, but it's also valuable to us in that we ourselves will not fall in the condemnation that Jesus gave to those who did the same thing of His day. And in chapter 23 of the book of Matthew, the pronouncements of woes there are extremely severe. Woe unto the man who says and does not, who teaches a certain thing and then does not do what he teaches. They're like, he compares them with many things, they're like a coffee cup. You'll pardon a modern day analogy. Like a coffee cup that's clean on the outside, but when you look inside, it's got mold on it. Any of you like to drink if a coffee cup's got mold on the inside? Or like they're like whited sepulchres. They're like beautiful, beautiful tombs. But on the inside of the tomb, you see, are the dead bones of those who've gone before. It says they appear to be something, but what they appear to be is not what they are. We owe it to ourselves. For our own sake, for our own peace of mind, for our own contentment, for our own example and influence, to do what we ask others to do, to follow what we claim to follow. To follow what we claim to teach others and insist on them following. We owe it to ourselves to do that. I was never as miserable in my life as I was when I was trying to be a Christian and also to be a member of the society of the world. And I don't think there are any more miserable people than those who are trying to keep one foot in, one foot out. Those who come to worship on Sunday morning and maybe Sunday night and then go home and drink during the week and carouse and play poker and all this kind of thing that goes along with the things of the world. I can't think of anyone that's more miserable than those kinds of people. Why? Because they're hypocritical. And they're trying to be double-minded. And Jesus said, you can't do it. It's a psychological impossibility to be happy in that condition. So you owe it to yourself to do what you teach, to do what the Bible teaches, and what you know you ought to teach. Now, another point that I want to make tonight is that we owe it to ourselves to love everyone, even our enemies. Now, you know that the Lord teaches that we ought to love our enemies. Matthew chapter 5 very plainly teaches that we ought to. And I know that sometimes that's a very difficult thing to do because I think this particular passage is talking about personal enemies. Those enemies who attack us and who have something all against us and who try to misuse us and abuse us and those kinds of who say things against us and maybe poke at us and all kinds of things, or maybe all financial enemies or business enemies or social enemies or whatever. But we're to love those kinds of people. And I'm not referring to the point in this obligation or to the obligation of the person as it relates to the person himself. In other words, what it does, what damage it does to his enemy. I'm talking about the obligation we have to ourselves, what it does for us. I have experienced, and I know you have as well, some people who have such hate and malice in their hearts toward others that they're literally eaten up with it. When you talk with them, it's not very long till they get around to the subject of saying, well, you know what he did to me 20 years ago? Well, I just want to tell you. Now, you know, I know a lot of people think a lot of him, but now you just wait till you hear what he did to me 20 years ago. And that kind of thing. Don't you know that's detrimental to a person? Shakespeare said that jealousy was a green-eyed monster going about seeking whom he may devour. Jealousy and malice and envy and hatred are like monsters within us. They're like literally cancers within us that eat us up from the inside out. Spiritually, emotionally, psychologically. Isn't it a shame that we let an enemy hurt us? You say, well, he's already hurt us. But isn't it a shame that we let him run us inside and keep us from being happy? I think it was Abraham Lincoln who said one time that one of these days he was going to get rid of his enemies. And one of his aides said, what do you mean, Mr. Lincoln? And he said, well, I'm going to make friends of them. Well, that's the way to get rid of an enemy, isn't it? And that's the way we ought to strive to get rid of ours. You know, it's awfully hard to hate someone that you pray for. We need to pray for our enemies. By name. Whoever they might be. Whatever they might have done. And we need to ask the Lord to help us to have the strength to forgive and forget. And then pray for them that they might improve or repent or whatever the case might be. We need to love them. We need to have concern for them. Avoid the destructive power of ascribing evil motives to others, of judging other people. Matthew chapter 7, verse 1 says that we ought not to judge one another. And judging simply means to attribute certain motives to actions that we have no right or knowledge to attribute. You know, I think, generally speaking, that Christians are not out to hurt somebody. I've known a few who have in, you know, kind of a an attitude, I'm going to get that person. But I've known there are very few, really. Most Christians are not out to hurt us. We ought to always assume the best motive behind an action rather than the worst. Not judge a person. You know, it may be that the reason I don't speak to you is because I have a terrible splitting sinus headache, not because I'm snubbing you. It may be that the reason that I didn't wave my hand as I went by and you were standing on the street and I drove by and didn't wave at you and you think, well, I tell you what, that Brother Doty thinks he's something, doesn't he? He doesn't even speak to people. It may be that I have something else on my mind and I didn't see you. You ever get that way? It may be that you know, when someone comes in and you happen to be overlooked for some unknown reason, for some reason that perhaps nobody really knows why you were overlooked, or something was left unsaid that should have been said, something was put in the bulletin that should have been put in the bulletin. It always ought to be the case that the Christian says, well, that was a mistake. They didn't intend to do that on purpose. If we'll have that attitude toward others, it seems to me that we'll be a lot better off. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 8, Paul says that we ought to put away from our hearts malice and envy and hatred. Put them away. Don't let them be there. Don't let them reside there. Don't let them stay there. Get rid of them. In Romans 12, Paul reminds us that we are not to take vengeance on our enemies, but rather to say, turn vengeance over to the Lord, for the Lord will repay, he says. Brother, I was out visiting with Brother Myers yesterday evening and last evening, and we were discussing his grandson and granddaughter with that, and he was telling me about, said, I used to hear the story all the time about some of the old preachers about the woman who came having trouble with her husband. I had heard this before, and I still think it's funny because I think it illustrates what I'm saying here. She came, she said, I just can't get along with him. He's a mean, cantankerous, no good rascal. And we just can't get along. And so the preacher suggested that she ask her, have you ever tried pouring coals of fire, heaping coals of fire on his head? And she replied by saying, no, I never have tried that, but I sure have used that black iron skillet of mine. And you know, that's the way some folks think, you see. Of course, what it's saying is, do good to your enemies. Try to make them friends. Do so much good to them. Help them so much and do always what is right toward them so that they cannot have anything to say against you. They're going to be your enemies. They'll be your enemies because they want to, not because you make them such. Well, we need to move on. We need to, in order to meet our obligations to ourselves, we need to be satisfied with what we have. Be satisfied with what we have. We could entitle this, develop the attitude of not trying to keep up with the Joneses, of not trying to be what we cannot be. We need to be careful that we do not let our ambitions get in our way of serving Christ. It's not wrong to be ambitious and to do the best we can. We've already talked about that. And to make as much money as we can, if it's done rightly, that we might use it to help others and use it for the Lord's work, and use it for the good of others, good of society. But having done our best, we should be willing to be thankful for what we have and say, thank you, Lord, for what we have. And not complain about what one does not have. You know, we are eaten up with a group of people and people in our society who believe that if I just had what he had, I'd be happy. Or if I just had what she had, I'd be happy. If I just had what they had, I'd be happy. You know, that's not true. It's not true. The grass always looks a little greener in somebody else's pasture. I recall I told the ladies the other day this little story. I used to drive back and forth to McKenzie, Tennessee, and there was one pasture every time, practically every time I went by, there was a goat who had his head outside the fence trying to eat the grass on the other side of the fence. He wasn't satisfied with the grass on his side. He wanted to have the grass on the other side. And there wasn't a bit of difference in the world between what was on his side of the fence and what was on the other side of the fence. And there are some people like that. Never satisfied with what we have. Never satisfied with what God has blessed us with. We always are trying to complain, always trying to make out that if I just had that, if I just had this, then I'd be happy. No, you wouldn't. Because you see, if you have that kind of attitude, there's not anything that can make you happy. Not a lasting happiness. It's a passing happiness. Philippians 4, verse 11 to 13, Paul talked about, he said, "Oh, I've learned whatever state I'm in therein to be content. If I'm without food, then I've learned to be without food. If I'm without clothing, then I've learned to be without clothing. If I'm blessed, then I have food and I have clothing and I have a home in which to live, then I'm satisfied with that. But I've learned the secret to be content in whatever state I'm in. And the secret is, I can do all things through Christ who strengtheneth me." Christ was his Lord. And that's the secret. Be willing to have Jesus Christ as our Lord and say, "I can do anything. I can handle any situation. I can handle any problem. I can overcome any difficulty. I can be content in whatever state I'm in, as long as I have the Lord as my Lord. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." And then, well, I need to cut out a point or two, so let me just mention this and then we'll close. We need to refuse to give in to failure. You owe it to yourself to refuse to give in to failure. You know, people are failures in many cases because they have been convinced that they're failures. We have either been convinced by those outside us or we've convinced ourselves that we're failures. Especially, I think, that I want to emphasize the fact that not every person who has an instance of failing in his life spiritually means that he's a failure. Just because we fall and we sin and we may even bring discredit upon the church. We may have crucified afresh and put the Lord to an open chain. We may have mistreated and brought blasphemy to the name of Christ. We may have done all kinds of terrible things, but we are not failures with Christ. Paul is a perfect example of this, as found in 1 Timothy chapter 1 verse 15. He said, "I was the chief of sinners, and yet through God's grace and God's mercy, I've been saved. I am what I am." God can take a life that is not worth much and make it worth the whole world. God can take your life, and even though you may feel that you've been a failure in life, God can help you be what you have the ability to be, and God will. The Lord has promised that He will. We need to claim the promise, and we need to begin to think in faith and trust in Him. And believe that God, with God's help, we can do what He would expect us to do. Even though we may not be the chief of sinners, nevertheless, when we fail, we have a failure, we make a mistake, we need to remember that the Lord will help us pick ourselves up and make us into something that will be worthwhile. We are not failures simply because we fail. We must have a positive attitude about the promises of God. When He says, "I can do all things through Christ who strengtheneth me." God can help us, and the Lord will help us. So you owe it to yourself not to give in to failure. Refuse to be a failure. Say, "Yeah, I failed, but with the Lord's help, I can do what He wants me to do." And you know, sometimes we've failed in visitation. Sometimes we've failed in soul winning. Sometimes we've failed in teaching the Bible. Sometimes we've failed in carrying out of work or program of work. And simply because we've failed does not mean that we're failures. So pick yourself up. Allow the Lord to strengthen you. And do again what you have the ability to do. Don't be a failure. In summary then, each person owes it to himself to be a Christian and to live a faithful Christian life. You owe it to yourself to do so. To become a Christian is simply, every man can accept Jesus Christ as the Son of God and repent of his sins, confess his faith, and be baptized into Christ. And to come back is just as simple, if not even more simple, to be willing to say, "I'm sorry. Lord, forgive me." God is just and faithful to do so.